On episode 2 of Inside the Lens, we get incredibly geeky. I have Ted Kinsman here, and we talk about electron microscopy. We push beyond the limits of photography, even in our second episode, so it's going to be a lot of fun. We go down a lot of rabbit holes that photographers never get to see, and get your propeller hat ready, because Inside the Lens is about to begin. I am here with Ted Kinsman, and you know, I'm so glad to have you on the podcast here, Ted. Especially very early on, and you know, we're bound to have you back on to talk about other stuff. But many years ago, when I was first getting into my extreme macro photography, I think our paths crossed, and that we've had some enlightening and for me very inspiring discussions about all things macro, especially on the scale beyond what I can even accomplish with the crazy camera gear that I have. I know that you're an expert in electron microscopy, or at least you're an expert to me. You've got all the fun tools and you know how to use them. So welcome to the conversation, Ted.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and chit chat about all things photographic or electron or physics or whatever happens.
Whatever happens. You know, I love these conversations because they're somewhat free-flowing at the end of it. So I mentioned that our conversation started around macro photography because there is a kind of a limit of light that that I think we face when we're trying to image things that are incredibly small. Yeah. And let's talk about that for a little bit, because I think that lends into the whole history of electron microscopy, doesn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. The optical microscopes are good down to about a thousandth power. So beyond that region, it's very difficult to get really good images. Nowadays, there's another form of optical microscopy, which is confocal, which is a whole nother ballgame.
But you can't do that in the field, right? You need
serious laboratory technique with multiple lasers and the whole deal. So that type of optical microscopy is as difficult as electron microscopy. And it doesn't have the ability to go to the limits that electron microscopy does.
So what are then the limits of light? You know, okay, so why is that limit in place that you can't resolve
light faster? That's the wavelength nature of light. But there's more to it than that. Like electron microscopy is really good for telling surface structures or the topography of a sample. Well, electron... Well, like optical photography, you can actually see into the sample. So you get different information on different magnification scales. So there's times when an optical microscope is easy and quick and you get the information. And there's other times when you have to go to the electron techniques.
So. And so I'm with my camera, my digital SLR and a macro lens. That's in my eyes, that's a maximum magnification in photography terms, we talk about life size magnification. And at one-to-one life size, I mean, if I were to take a frame of film, let's go back to that era because it's a great comparison to make. If I take a frame of film and I shoot at one-to-one life size a photograph of a quarter on that frame of film, and then I get that film developed and I hold that frame of film up to the actual quarter and I overlap them together, they fit exactly. And so in photographic terms that a lot of our audience would probably be familiar with, that is sort of the magnification factors that photographers usually are familiar with. But what they don't realize is that at every magnification factor that you add, 1:1, 2:1, 3:1, as you continue to get closer and closer, you add one stop to your effective aperture. And so in rough sense, I mean, there's some pupil calculations too that we don't usually have the numbers for that might offset it.
Yeah.
But in the sense of photography, if I'm shooting at, say, I've got a special lens that does 5:1 magnification, I think you've got the same lens. It's the Canon MPE 65 millimeter lens. It's a wonderful tool, a very difficult one to use, but it's a wonderful tool. At 5:1 magnification, if I have my camera set at F16, I have to add 5 stops to that. That's like F96 or something similar. And if I'm trying to shoot at extremely highly magnified levels, like I've got equipment that lets me do all the way up to 12:1. Now, using that lens plus some extension tubes on there, which brings it to 6:1. And then you can use like a a telephoto converter, or you can use a Canon makes a life-size converter for one of their macro lens that basically just doubles the magnification factor. It's up to 12:1 magnification. Now, if I take the maximum aperture on this lens, which is f2.5, and I add 12 stops to that, I'm at f180. And at f180, the wave nature of light is the culprit, right?
Yeah. Well, the wave nature of the electron itself allows for much finer resolution. But there's a world of difference between an optical camera and an electron microscope. And what most people don't realize is that an electron microscope takes a beam of electrons and focuses that beam of electrons down to a very tight point on a surface. And it's that electron's interaction with the surface, which is visualized through photomultipliers and collecting the electrons that are emitted from the surface. What people don't realize is you're not taking a picture through an electron microscope all at once. The picture is taken pixel by pixel by pixel. So you can kind of think of it as like a musical song. You don't get to experience the whole song until all the notes are played. And what the electron microscope does is it collects an image or a song note by note by note.
So it's the mother of all grid panoramas.
Pretty much. That's a great way of actually thinking of it, because each pixel is collected at an individual point in time. And they can be collected, an image could be collected in 3 or 4 seconds, or a very large image like 4 or 5,000 pixels across might take 5 to 8 minutes to collect, depending on the system that's used.
So you have static subjects, and so electrons, they don't interact with things in the same way that light interacts with things either.
No, not at all. It actually, you can think of it as almost like an electron bomb hitting a surface, and the electrons actually penetrate the surface, and which is called the penetration volume, and it looks like a teardrop shaped sort of interaction. But in that little volume, the electrons hit the sample, and then they give off what's called secondary electrons. And those secondary electrons are pulled into a detector. And that's one form of electrons that can be detected on that electron sample interaction.
So, yeah, there's at least two different kinds of electron microscopy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's actually a couple others. There's photons can be given off, which is cathode luminescence, which is not used so much. It's actually got little bit of interest in that technique recently in some of the biological work, but more commonly is in material science. They use another electron, which is shot right back, which is called a backscattered electron. And that's kind of comparable to shooting a tennis ball at a wall, and that tennis ball bounces back off the wall. And those are detected to look for different materials. The higher the atomic number, the easier it is for those electrons to bounce back. And of course, when the electron hits a sample, it also gives off X-rays. And so all of those things can be measured to get information about a sample.
This is fascinating stuff, because it reminds me of the stuff that, you know, NASA puts up a satellite into orbit to collect X-rays, to collect all very specific frequencies of light, and then somehow combines them together into something that is not only scientifically meaningful, but is also unbelievably beautiful for us to look at. And I know that you've had some great electron images that I've seen in the past, of anything from parts, like obscure, weird parts of plants, to cells and viruses, that the scale of which is impossible to do with light. Although, I mean, I've seen people do electron images of snowflakes and things like that, which you could actually visualize.
There's actually only a couple of those. And they're really tricky to do.
Well, because you got to keep the subject cold, I would imagine. You probably have to cover it with something before you even get started, so that the electrons bounce off of it properly, right?
Well, the cool thing about water is that when you get it cold enough, it becomes very conductive. So beyond -150 degrees Celsius, it starts to become pretty conductive. And if you can get it down that low, then you can put it in a scanning electron microscope, and it doesn't sublimate, but it still is conductive. So it sort of works out. But that's a tricky image to take. And there's only a couple of those done, which I think were done by the National Bureau of Standards in in Washington.
But they're beautiful. The point of this is that when I see those images and I know where I am with photography, and even if I can get something at that scale, what you don't really realize with the electron images that you gather, that other professionals in that field gather, is that the depth of field is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. When I'm doing the most extreme macro work, my depth of field is a fraction of a millimeter. But in most of the electron work that I've seen,
it's a fraction of a millimeter for me too, most of the time. But that fraction of a millimeter represents a tremendous depth compared to the magnification you're at.
Exactly.
So yeah, but yeah, you can adjust the apertures and you can adjust the sample distance. And it's a lot. There's a lot of similarities with working with opticals, with the sense that a small aperture will give you a large working depth of field.
So there is similarities when we're talking photography, we're talking ISO, we're talking shutter speed, we're talking aperture. At least you've got an aperture.
Electron optics are somewhat similar to actual optical optics. They call it electron optics, which is kind of a weird thing, but the electrons actually go in corkscrew patterns with the magnetic fields generated with the lenses. But corkscrew patterns aside, it all works out mathematically to be just like a simple lens. And the aperture that you use in the microscope affects the depth of field. The working distance, the distance between the final electron lens and the sample, will affect your depth of field also. So I've
photographed, the smallest objects that I've photographed are like grains of pollen, and they might mm-hmm. measure around 70 microns long or so with optics. And that's kind of the realm where electron microscopy picks up, right? We're talking about like less than a tenth of a millimeter or so in size that visual stuff can. And then you go much, much smaller than that. What is the limit of resolution that you can get? What's the smallest thing that you can see?
Well, let's see. Most of my machines, their magnification starts around 35 to 50x. And I have three machines in the lab right here, and they pretty much tap out around 100,000x. So, but that's still, the neighboring university has a nano facility, which I often get into and use their machines. And that machine will tap out at a little bit over a million X. And it's pretty fascinating. You can actually visualize and see a cluster of five gold atoms. And when you can do that, it's pretty phenomenal. I mean, after that, anything's easy. But
that gets the inner geek and scientist and all of us somewhat giddy to think technology, yeah, you can do that. I mean, the equipment is obviously not within the range of the average person to even dream of getting their hands on. But the fact is that that's sitting there. You can image an atom. Now, okay, we're talking to photographers here though, because there has to be some level of both scientific value and beauty to the work being created. And so five atoms, I'm sure it's fascinating, but I don't know if that's necessarily the most beautiful thing that's ever been imaged in front of an electron microscope.
No, but they do some really cool stuff. Right now I'm working on a project where I'm visualizing paramecium and pond water samples. So I have a little sample of pond water, and I have to prepare it with a solution of glutaraldehyde, which is a preservative. And then after I do that, I have to run it through a series of alcohols to dry the specimen out and to get rid of all the water. And then the specimen gets put in a device which is called a critical point dryer, which you got to realize this sample is about the size of a dime. And the critical point dryer removes all of the water and solvents in the sample, because the sample has to be completely dry to go into this high vacuum inside the microscope. The next step that this pond goo has to do is I have to gold coat it with a system called a sputter coater, which puts probably about a quarter of a micron of gold coating on it, which means it's electric, it's conductive, and that's a great way to shed the extra electrons that hit the sample. And then I'm all set to visualize and look at it. So here I've got this this sample that's about the size of a dime, and I'm looking at something that's equivalently the size of a micron. And so I can spend pretty much a whole day looking at this sample to try to find out if there's any paramecians squirreled in the different openings or nooks and crannies of this sample that I want to photograph. And so sometimes you spend a lot of time just looking over a sample to try to find, is there a good specimen there to photograph? So it's kind of like you walking over a field and you're going to photograph a nice cricket or a little butterfly, but you can't see that cricket or butterfly until you're like 3 or 4 inches away from it.
Yeah. And the whole field might be, gigantic, and you're hunting for that one specific point of interest and you're not sure where it's going to end up. So I'm sure now, how do you do that with, do you have like some sort of a visual aid? Because you said that with the electron microscope, it might take 5 to 8 minutes to image something, but are you shooting blind or?
Well, there's a preview imagery, which there's a difference between like taking a final image and a preview. So it's kind of like switching channels. You've got a low resolution TV and you keep moving the sample around and looking at the low resolution samples, and when you finally find a good spot, then you hit the take a picture button, and it builds that picture over a lot of time.
And so these end result images, I've seen a lot of them that have color, but I wouldn't imagine that electrons can give you color information at all.
No, this is a huge problem because I'm involved with my primary use of scanning electron microscopy is to generate images for education and to get pretty much young people interested in science and just show the cool stuff that takes place in science. So to do that, the images really have to be in color to engage young viewers. So because the electrons, when you record an image, the image is really linked to how many electrons are given off per pixel. So a bright spot on a scanning electron microscope represents a lot of electrons reflected or secondary electrons or backscattered electrons or what have you coming from that particular pixel. So it's a black and white image. And then the process is they have to be colorized. And typically they're hand colorized, which means that each image might be anywhere from an hour to 4 or 5 hours to colorize, depending on how much work you want to do on it. Or I've recently come up with some techniques where I combine images from different detectors and apply a different color to each detector. And through the wonders of Photoshop, can come up with a colorized image in probably 5 to 10 minutes.
Interesting.
Almost an automated technique,
so,
which is kind of cool.
The different detectors will provide you sort of almost, it's not like we're talking wavelengths here. We're just talking that they represent the same subject matter in a different way, as if I have like something that I could throw into a red channel and a blue channel and see how they interact.
I'll take like the secondary electron image and I'll put that into a red channel. I'll take the backscattered image and I'll put that into a blue channel, and I'll have this this trippy psychedelic picture of whatever it is I'm taking.
And so, it's not representative of any actual colors or anything. It's just a visual aid, right?
And that's a problem because scientifically, you really like to have colors represent something. So when you do a colorization of a scanning electron, if you're photographing human tissue, you might pick reds or something like that. So that's just for the viewer's aid, because you typically might be down so far that optical wavelengths have no meaning there anyhow.
Exactly.
So if I'm photographing a bacteria that's just a few fractions of a micron across, it might be the same wavelength as blue light, but who knows what color it really is.
True. Now, if you had like a vial full of exclusively that bacteria and it reflected a particular color, that might give you some indication as to what an individual piece of it would be able to be colorized as. But the opportunities for that, I think, are few and far between.
Yeah, it's usually just you're colorizing. It's late at night. You're listening to some music and you're like, I'd like a pink virus right now. And later on you can change it to green or something. But once you develop the the layers in Photoshop, each with a different color, then you can adjust them. And
now in Photoshop, do you use like the hue and saturation adjustment layer, and you click the little colorize button and you start painting on with a particular color, or what's the technique that you go through?
It can be that simple. There's actually about six different techniques. One is to just pick a color, and you can paint that color as a new layer with a colorization attribute for that layer.
Or a blending mode or something that allows it.
You can change the blending modes. A lot of times you can use a drop shadow to increase the interest. Although that's sort of, you're changing the image around. But
yeah, you're writing the line between scientific viability and aesthetics, right?
Aesthetics, yeah. And a lot of times, you got a great scientific shot, and now the question is to take it to that next level and make it really stand out as a beautiful representation of something.
So, I like this conversation. I want to go out and make my own electron microscope. How would I do that, Ted?
Well, let's see. Making your own electron microscope, you might want to get a degree in physics first. you can study a lot of math along the way. You're going to need that for the electron optics.
The reason why I ask is because I know they're so absurdly expensive. How much?
They can be. If you were to go out today and go to like Zeiss and say, I would like a top of the line nano level microscope, and say you don't get a lot of bells and whistles on it, is probably going to set you back around $600,000. But you really want all those extra bells and whistles, so that'll probably bring you in around $1 million. But keep in mind, there's more to it than that. So you've just spent $1 million on your machine. There's something called a maintenance contract that you're going to want to have helped out, because it's kind of like I don't even know what it's like. It's like a really expensive car that breaks down every few miles. Something will break down on it.
It's like the very first computers. It's like the UNIVAC 1. And yeah, you have to hire full-time employees to go around and change out vacuum tubes, right?
Yeah, but a maintenance contract on a top-of-the-line microscope for doing nano research, and I was just showing one of these last week, is $60,000.
A year?
A year.
Wow.
So you better have that in your funding for keeping everybody running.
And so that really says to everybody that's listening, well, I'll never, ever be able to experience what we're talking about in this conversation. Is that true, or is there?
No, that's for the top of the, this is like the peak research. Canada has three of those machines, I think, in all of Ontario. One's at I think Queen's College has one, and I think there's two others in Ontario.
Oh, and we should mention that you work at RIT, the Rochester Institute of Technology.
I work at Rochester Institute of Technology. I have three scanning electron microscopes, but they're not at that level. My machines typically only go, since they're used for biological work, most of the times the kids are imaging less than 30,000x. So these are not state-of-the-art machines, and they can't go to the levels that a nano researcher would need.
Well,
so hence they're a lot less expensive.
A lot less. Well, and so in that case, if we're looking to can I buy one on eBay? Like, is that something that exists?
Yes, you can buy one on eBay. Let's see. I have actually seen some really nice machines go on eBay for $10,000.
You know what? People spend more than that on a camera lens. So,
exactly. Yeah. Well, so why not buy one? You got room right there. I see you got a lot of room in the background there. Get rid of that brown couch. Put a scanning electron microscope right there. It'd fit in that corner.
Wouldn't it, though? I think that I'd have some. I need to get spousal approval on one of those, though.
Oh, heck no.
No, sweetheart. It's a business expense, really.
It is a business. She might like running it. You never know.
It's exploring the world in a different way. As photographers, we're all exploring the world. When we're going into the microscopic, electron microscopy kind of subject matter. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you've been amazed numerous times at the kind of things that show up as an image.
Oh, it is. It is. And it's fascinating to see the structures and to talk with researchers. And you get down and you look at all the guts, the little teeny tiny pieces of like a mosquito eye, and each eye has three little neurons on it.
Now,
and stuff.
Who funds the research into mosquito eyes? I mean, what's the...
Oh, actually, there's a huge amount of mosquito research because...
malaria and things like that, I guess.
Yeah. Mosquitoes are actually a big problem. So as far as insects goes, mosquitoes is one of the more researched of the insects because of the issues involved with the disease, carrying diseases and the human interactions and stuff.
Now,
but you can see all that structure and you're like, oh, that's, you know, that's what I experience every time one lands on me and I, you know, like got it, you know, smack it. And it splatters all over the place. And
you know, I've gone out to do some photo shoots. We were talking about one before we started recording, a Star Trail image that I had made in Killarney Provincial Park, a place that you've canoed by, I think you had mentioned. Yep. And, man, it was like giving blood. I'm sure I covered myself with enough DEET to give me some kind of cancer a few years from now in order to fend off those mosquitoes. It's interesting to see that kind of research. And the fact that you're doing on a regular basis is fascinating to me because you've probably been doing it for a very long time. How long have you been into that field for?
I've been working with scanning electron microscopes since around 2005. So really about 10 years I've been in that field.
And I want to kind of drill into this. What was your first experiences with it? And what were the most fascinating, interesting things that you've seen in that past decade under an electron microscope?
Wow. It's really hard to say. I've looked at everything from microfossils to, I go on vacation and I'll bring little buckets of pond scum home. You know, sometimes I'm not supposed to, but one of the deals, you're not supposed to smuggle what they call extremophiles out of Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming. But one of the reasons I actually went hiking in Wyoming was to bring home some of its extremophiles for the microscope.
And for the record, you decided not to do that because you weren't allowed to, right?
I wasn't allowed to. Yeah. but anyhow, you look at those extremophiles and you're like, what the heck are these things? How can they be alive? And you visualize, you're able to take pictures of that stuff and use them for educational purposes and things like that. But there's life all around. And even on the smallest piece, if you're in the middle of a hiking trail, you're like, hey, look at this rock. It's green. What's up with that? And you can take a little sample of that, snap the rock in half, and you can actually visualize some sort of weird lichen that grows on this rock and goes in a fraction of a millimeter and is actually breaking the rock apart. So that's kind of a cool thing.
And but, if you were to go to Antarctica and take an ice core sample and melt that down and take a look at whatever was found within that, you'd find interesting things there too. If you broke a piece of rock open, you would probably find some microorganisms that long ago had somehow lived inside of that, whether they be a fossil or not.
Stuff can be all over the place. And that's true. You really can't escape life here on Earth. And you'll see those structures, whether they're diatoms or, whatever kinds of fossils or something like that. I've actually got some great samples that were just sent to me from the bottom of the Mediterranean, and they have deep water radiolarii on them, which are these beautiful little structures that look like geodesic domes and holes and stuff in them, and they're really fantastically beautiful. They've been photographed before, but still they're kind of like the supermodels of the microscopy world. You know, everybody wants to take pictures of them, and you never get tired of looking at them.
I'd love to see that image. Now, you haven't imaged them yet, though, you said.
Yes, I have imaged those.
Oh, well, then maybe you can, because you say that there's something of a supermodel. Yeah. I'd like to see a picture of that. Maybe we could put it in the show notes for this episode.
Sure.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of really interesting things. I like diatoms are a common freshwater and saltwater microbe And they come in all different shapes and sizes, and they eat rotten leaves in the fall in the streams. I think they're one of the predominant decomposers in the streams in the fall.
I think I saw a picture when we had gotten together once in the past. I think you showed me one where you were coloring all of the different species of these on a leaf.
Yep.
And for me, I mean, okay, this is, I like to say the world of macro photography is the universe at our feet. But really, there is an entirely different level of that that is just completely obscured by light, because light just doesn't cooperate. And you've got to take out that electron microscope to get into the next level down. Now, is there a level beyond that? Like you said, you can measure atoms, right? With some of the highest.
You can't go down the atoms. It's really difficult to do it. And don't think like, you know, the researchers that do that are just going to sit down and go after that in an afternoon. It really takes a while to get the machine tuned to that kind of resolution. Typically, they use a different machine for those high magnifications, and that's something called a TEM, which stands for a transmission electron microscope. And in that case, little tiny structures are cut very, very thin. When I say very thin, they're like a fraction of a micron thick.
And transmission, like I know, you know, transmission optics
actually go through.
Yeah, so like in optical principles, transmission or transmitted light would be passing through the subject. Say if you've got it on a microscope slide, and then you capture the results, and that's also possible with electrons too. So thin that the electrons interact in some way, but still pass through it.
Exactly, they'll pass through, and you can kind of think of that as having a slide in a slide projector. Where that little tiny sample is that thin slide that you put in your slide projector. But instead of projecting it on a wall across the room, you project it on a wall that's like 10 miles away. And it's just, you know, huge. And that's a transmission electron microscope. And they routinely operate at 250,000 to 500,000 magnifications. And they're a whole nother game. They're very high energies, and the interactions with the samples can be very extreme. So that was actually the first kind of microscope invented in the 1930s.
Really? The 1930s that came about?
1930s, yeah.
Wow.
It was the first transmission electron microscope in Europe. And it wasn't until the mid-60s that the Cambridge microscope started to hit the market.
Well, okay, so but I got to wrap my head around 1930s. Here I am thinking that this is a construct of the digital era, that this is something that existed once we had computers and the ability to record all of this information digitally. Were you making images, or were you...
They would actually record the images on a sheet of film.
They would
project the electrons onto a sheet of film, and then over the course of... I don't know what the exposures were, maybe 10 or 15 minutes, they would actually develop, they would actually create an image on that film of the electrons. So surprising side note, some of that research was done at the University of Toronto, and the first working transmission electron microscope, or the first electron microscope in the world, and in North America, was at the University of Toronto, and that is was still on display at the Science Center in Toronto. It was in one of the back rooms, tacked to the side of a wall with a little plaque underneath it.
Collecting dust, I'm sure, because nobody knows what it is or why it's still there in the corner.
And you know, you get there and you're like, oh, look at that! It's like, you know, let's just get down on our knees and worship below it. But it's there, and I think I think it might have been on the wall there the last time I visited, maybe 8 or 10 years ago.
But by the sound of it, Ted, you've got your finger on the pulse of a lot of this stuff. So I'm curious, you know, you know where things have come, you know where things are now. Like, are there still advancements being made in this field, or have we exhausted the resolution that an electron microscope can attain?
That's a hard thing to predict. Right now, the future is in really strange, well, let's just say one of the things right now is in the world of biology is you want to really understand the connection of all the neurons, say in like a human brain. So what some of these companies have done is they've built a special scanning electron microscope that instead of having one scanning beam, have 64 scanning beams. And they all take 64 pictures at once. I'm not sure the layout of the inside of these chambers, but remember, it all has to take place at a vacuum. So what these machines do is they take like a 2 by 2 inch chunk of, say, human brain, and it's frozen because you can keep it cold and it's not going to give off gases that are going to hurt the vacuum system. And it's placed inside the electron microscope, and a 1 micron sheet is chopped off of it, is shaved off the top of this chunk of material.
So it's imaged by 64 separate beams, and then
at the same time,
and then they shave a layer off and then do it again and again and again
and again. And what they get is a 3D picture of the neurons, and their researchers are now working towards building a 3D model of all of the neurons, connectivities of all of the neurons in a human brain. They think that project might be 10 or 15 years out. So to simplify the process, they thought, well, let's start with something like the optical neuron, the neurons in the optical cord from the eye. If we can get an idea of what's happening there.
Or image like a mouse brain or something like that to see how that kind of falls through.
Something relatively simple that you could do in 3 or 4 years. But that's the idea of where do all those neurons go? How are they all connected to each other? And what is that actual structure? And one of the ways of doing that is with these fancy electron microscopes. But don't think that that's the end of it, because there's other kinds of materials that can interact. And one of them is a helium ion microscope, which instead of using an electron, uses a helium ion. And that helium ion is much heavier. It has a smaller wave function than an electron, which is bizarre. And you can do some really strange things with that. So different types of images and different types of research that are on the horizon.
That's crazy. So, you know, and here I am thinking.
And then you can also use gallium ions, too.
I guess all of these exotic ideas come up when you push the limits of something. So electron microscopy can only take you so far in so many different directions. And so then you have to discover new ways to approach maybe the same subject matter maybe those helium ions will see it differently, even at the same resolution, but have a different way of interacting. Maybe it can be used at different temperatures, or it can interact in different ways.
And that's actually... many of the pictures that you see now associated with scanning electron microscopy are actually what's abbreviated as FIB images. And what an FIB microscope is a focused ion beam. And they usually use gallium. Liquid gallium is the source of the ions. And that gives a little bit different picture. And it can also give pictures with a lot less noise in them than the similar scanning electron microscope pictures at a high magnification.
I think this is so much fun.
Just one technique. There's so many different techniques.
It's amazing to see how like science is using, like, photography is a relative term. I mean, we're not using photons here at this point. But it's using images to not only help discover new things, from extremophile organisms and identifying the different bits and pieces of how the brain works. I mean, there's no other way that I could think of that you'd be able to do that. And the technology in order to accomplish that, like you said, 10, 15 years out. But that reminds me of when, you know, the human genome was first mapped, and how much effort, how gargantuan that project would have been. And now it's almost an everyday thing that can be done on an individual basis. I mean, it would cost a lot, but it's now, you know what? You want that to happen? You just sign up for it.
And things are constantly changing, but the ability, if you think, is we're really visual animals and we really like to see a picture, and these machines help researchers, or they help people interested in science to see a picture, to not only get interested in a subject, but maybe help them understand a subject. What's going on in that structure? When I look down deep, I'm interested in this process. I'm interested in how this organism moves or behaves or whatever. And you can look at it in a very, very detailed structure, which helps us understand. So that's what the images are all about, you know, helping us understand the world around us.
And I look forward to seeing more stuff from you in this field, Ted. It's been a great chat. Thank you so much for sitting down with me to have this conversation. Is there a place where people can go to find some of your work or to get in touch with you if they have any questions?
Sure. They can follow me on Instagram at EMKPPH, which happens to be my email at RIT. Or they can go to a website, which is sciencephotography.com, or they can just Google me and look at, I don't know, weird images that are used on cell phones or something.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And I know that I'm going to have you back on at some point in the future, too, to talk about, I know you do a lot of stuff with extremely high-speed flash photography, and who knows what other conversations we can get into that involve sort of the extreme limits of what you can see, or at least what we can
X-ray
image.
X-ray work. Don't forget X-rays.
I know. I've seen some of your X-rays of things like flowers and household objects that are just fascinating.
Yeah,
so
I just did one on freak flowers.
Oh, geez. So. That's fun. I can't wait to see that too. But
and seaweeds.
And seaweed too. You know, those make beautiful art pieces.
Those are sort of for art, to get people interested in the sciences and think, okay, X-rays, you know, what hasn't been seen in X-rays? I'll have to come back on and give you an earful of X-ray too.
You'll keep us on the edge of our seats. And if you want to find out more about this podcast, any images that we might have talked about here, check it out at the thisweekinphoto.com website. You'll find a link that has this exact podcast, episode number 2, in there. And if you want to see more of my work, you can find it there as well. All my contact information is there or at doncom.ca. Thanks so much. You know, it's conversations like this that really make me happy as a photographer, because I can push into new limits. I can explore new areas of, I don't even want to call it photography. It's optics, it's imagery. It's exploring the world that we can't see with our own eyes. And I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation. There will be many more of this coming soon. So stay tuned for the next episode.